and welcome. Thank you so much for coming this evening. My name is Elizabeth Gregg. I'm a nurse practitioner at the Blum Center for Health in Rye Brook. We are a functional medicine, lifestyle, and nutrition center. Have any of you ever heard of functional medicine other than the two people that I know who've been there before? Come on in. Functional medicine is a kind of medicine that gets at the root of your symptoms and your problems rather than the end result, which we think of as disease. The metaphor that I like is a tree. If you think of the human being as a tree and, you know, the leaves start to get a little spindly and they start falling off the tree and you go to the tree doctor and the doctor says, oh, your leaves are falling off. Here, take this medicine, stick it to the leaf, glue it back on the end of the branch. It'll stay there for a while. We're not sure how long, but we'll slow down the fall of leaves. And, you know, that's the best we can do. And that's traditional medicine's approach to chronic disease. I did that for many years. We just try and slow down the progression. However, in functional medicine, what we do is we say, well, what's going in at the root of your tree? What are you feeding it? What kind of water is it drinking? Is there any air pollution? Is there any other kind of pollution? And as we start to take the pollution away and fix what's going in at the roots in terms of food and perhaps nutritional supplements and sometimes some herbs, the tree starts to get better. And it starts to put out new leaves, or it holds on to the leaves that it has. And we see this time and again in functional medicine, that if you fix the foundations, then the problems start to disappear. And so that's a pricey of functional medicine. Tonight, I'm going to talk about stress and metabolism. What's the link? We often hear stress makes you sick, right? And the question is, well, how does stress make us sick? What exactly is happening inside the body that makes stress make us feel sick? And what can we do about it? We can't stop the world. So, you know, if stress is all those things that are happening out here, it's not in our power to stop them. But what we can work on is our internal response to that stress. What's happening inside when the stress is happening out here? So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So what is stress? A scientist in the 1930s described stress as the non-specific response of the body to any demand. So that means the response could be an up response or a down response. It didn't talk about direction of response. It just means that something, it's like there's an action and there's a reaction. So that was his definition of stress, and it applied to negative events, positive events, and how we experience it. So it's how you take it. It's like what happens on the inside when you're exposed to that stress. And so it's different for different people, right? Different people respond differently to stress. The acute stress response, this is the one that we're all familiar with, right? It's what happens when we're stepping off the curb to cross the street and some motorcyclist comes out of nowhere and we have to jump back off the curb, right? So we have an immediate response. We have to get out of the way and move. And we could stand there and try and fight off that motorcycle, but most of us will step back and try and get away. And that's the classic stress response, the fight or flight stress response. When that happens, certain things happen in our physiology. We put out certain hormones, cortisol and adrenaline. Adrenaline is the classic stress response hormone. And when those go surging out, it makes our heart rate go up, makes our breathing go up, and pours blood into our big muscles so we can run like crazy to get out of the way. The other thing that happens is it takes blood away from the digestive tract, right? Because when you're trying to run out of the way of the motorcycle or the lion or the tiger or the bear, you don't need to be able to digest your food in that moment, right? And so the body is conserving energy and moving it to where it really counts when we're trying to get away from the stress. So when we're really stressed, we don't digest well. Blood is not going to our digestive organs. The opposite of that, we call the relaxation response. In the 1960s, there was a psychiatrist at Harvard named Herb Benson, and he was kind of looking at what was happening with the meditation revolution, and he was very interested to know what's the scientific reason for why meditation works? Because scientists had noticed that blood pressure goes down, heart rate goes down, breathing goes down when people meditated, and he was very interested in that. And so he and his colleagues started looking at what happens in the nervous system, and they found that there was this opposite kind of relaxation response, was what he ended up calling it, in the nervous system. There are two branches of the nervous system in our autonomic or automatic nervous system. That's the part of the nervous system that controls, you know, how our liver works, how our kidney works, our breathing, our heart rate, so that we don't have to think about them, right? They're just going on all the time. And in that all the time, everyday system, there's a stress contraction response, and there's an opening relaxation response. And those two parts of the nervous system are always working with each other. And sometimes we're predominantly contracted, and sometimes we're predominantly open and expanded. Sometimes we're pretty balanced. And what he found is that in the stress state, people were really, the systems are contracted. And in the relaxation phase, things are open. Breathing goes down, and there is this sense of relaxation. So these two systems, you're never kind of all in one or all in another. You can be predominantly, or you can be a bit balanced. What we know is that these chemical changes in the body add up. Stress creates inflammatory molecules. So those chemicals, the adrenaline and the cortisol that are pouring into the bloodstream, stimulate certain things to happen in the body that produce inflammation. This chronic stress and chronic level of cortisol, so the body was meant to human beings were meant to kind of see the stressor, see the lion or tiger and bear, get out of harm's way, and then the tiger and lion are gone, and we're supposed to just go and go back to gathering nuts and berries, and all is okay. But the way we live our lives now, that doesn't really happen, does it? It's like you read the news, or you listen to the radio, or the 11 o'clock news is like my worst my best example of the worst that we can do to ourselves. Those kinds of things, we just subtly kind of can't, don't you feel yourself kind of going like this when you hear the bad news on the radio? There's just that little bit of contraction, a little bit of shrug, a little bit of, I want to get away from that. We almost don't even notice that we do that because we're so used to it. We're so constantly in that slightly tense, slightly contracted state. And this is the chronic stress state where we don't even notice it so much. But when we're in that state, this hormone cortisol is coming out, and it leads to insulin resistance, which is the first step to diabetes. It raises our blood pressure. It makes us put on fat around the middle. So when we can't lose weight, and particularly when we keep gaining weight around the middle, this is often related to our stress hormones. It keeps us from making new cells from protein. It interferes with the repair of DNA, which is a function of the immune system. So it interferes with our immune system's ability to kind of do its cleanup job. And it also weakens the immune system by decreasing the production of new cells, red cells and white cells that fight infection and fight other invaders to the body. So, what are some of the stressors besides the things that we talked about, besides events, right? What we eat. So, the adrenal glands are these little glands that sit one on top of each kidney. They're about this big, and they're the ones that are making that cortisol and adrenaline. And when they've been working overtime, the adrenals kind of start to run out of the building blocks for what they need to do to make their the chemicals that they make in the body, and they become fatigued. And when they become fatigued, we feel fatigued. So adrenal fatigue is one of the causes of that kind of chronic tiredness, where you kind of just wake up tired in the morning, or you don't get a good night's sleep. Classically, you wake up in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning, and you have a hard time going back to sleep. And what we often do And then you get the 4 o'clock crash. So, you know, you're powering through your day, you have lunch, and you hit somewhere between 3 and 5. Most people, that's the time, and they just, like, the energy just dives. Anybody recognize that? Right. And so what do? We go for a cup of coffee or something with sugar or some kind of simple carb. Maybe we go for pretzels or a bag of cookies or a bag of chips, but some simple carb, because carbs turn to sugar. Those kinds of grainy carbs turn to sugar, and sugar will increase our energy, right? It's absorbed rapidly, and when we get a big rush of sugar into the bloodstream, for that amount of time, we'll feel energy. But when that sugar goes up, insulin also goes up, and that drops our blood sugar, and we crash about a half an hour, maybe an hour after we eat that carb. And so then we're kind of ravenous for dinner. Caffeine does a similar thing. It will rev us up for 30 minutes, maybe 45, and then we'll crash as our level of caffeine starts to go off from the coffee. When the caffeine and the sugar come in, it's kind of like whipping a dead horse, right? Your adrenals are tired. And what you're doing is really you're kind of stepping on them and saying, no, you know, give me some more, I need it. And so the adrenals will do what they can, but once you back off on the gas pedal, the adrenals are even that much more tired. You know, we just are forcing them to keep producing when they're not really ready to. Then what happens is when your adrenals get tired enough, and this usually happens as we hit our late 40s and early 50s, because most of us in our 20s, 30s, and 40s, that's the time when we're like most productive, right? We're raising families, we're doing our job, we're running around like crazy, our calendar is totally full, we're burning the candle at both ends. And then we get to the 50s and we start to hit the change of life. And the adrenals need to pick up some of the slack of our hormone production, and they can't do it. And so we really hit this wall of fatigue. And so the thyroid gland, which is here, is another one of our energy production glands. It tries to pick up the slack, and then it gets stressed. So adrenals, and then thyroid, and then blood sugar and insulin, all of those systems start to run into problems as we hit the fifth decade of life, because of the stress that we've experienced in our 20s, 30s, and 40s without really having the tools always to handle it. Any questions so far?
You mentioned caffeine. You know, there's so much controversy. I mean, I hear now that caffeine is good for a lot of different things.
What we say is caffeine in moderation. You know, that mostly what we tell people is one cup a day, you know, to get your day started. But to look at why you're using caffeine, like if you're using it because your energy just crashed, then maybe the better thing to stand back and say, well, why did my energy just crash? You know, did I not get enough sleep last night? Did I not eat the right things for lunch? You know, did I not have protein that would have carried me through the crash? And then sometimes we drink coffee because it's social and it's fun and we like to have another cup, you know. So part of it is just looking to see, why am I drinking more coffee? Like,
does coffee or caffeine have any effect on your metabolism? Some people say it speeds it up, but is there any truth to that?
There is some truth to that, because it will have an effect on this cortisol thing, which will do blood sugar. But I would say that it's more the other way, that it will eventually become a drag on your metabolism, even though you'll get a quick energy to start with.
There's so much positive that's said about green tea,
right?
So does that mean it should always be decaffeinated?
Not necessarily. Green tea has much less caffeine in it. It's like a third, I think.
Maybe even less.
Maybe even less, yeah. And so, you know, if you're not particularly caffeine sensitive, then I think it's not such an issue. There are some people who are exquisitely sensitive to caffeine, and it does make a difference. And if you're truly in a state of adrenal fatigue, it's probably better to avoid caffeine. But for the average person, just drinking regular green tea probably works. Yeah. All right. So, sources of stress. Some of these things we can do things about, and some we can't. So it's useful to kind of think about, well, what are the sources of stress that I can do something about? So the self-generated sources of stress: not getting enough sleep, eating an unhealthy diet, eating when we're stressed, not getting enough exercise, and our emotions. I want to speak particularly to eating under fight or flight conditions, so eating when we're stressed. This is the classic fast food experience, right, where we're in a hurry, and whether we're driving into a fast food place or we're eating at our desk in a hurry and answering emails and answering phone calls, that's that state, right, where we're slightly contracted. We're not focused on what we're doing, so we're not chewing our food very well. So our food goes down kind of only partially chewed. It hits a stomach that's not got a lot of proper blood supply, because remember how we talked about stress takes blood away from the digestion. So then your digestion doesn't work quite so great. And then it moves on into the intestines with partially digested food. And most of us have bacterial imbalances in our intestines because of all the antibiotics we've been on. So you have a bacterial flora that's not really strong to begin with, and you put partially digested food, and you can kind of see, right? It just keeps going with why so many people have indigestion and reflux in particular. I mean, how many ads are there out there for Prilosec and Nexium and those proton pump inhibitors? GERD is the most common over-the-counter medication, I think, used today. And part of it is this stress eating. When we eat like that, that really disorders our ability to digest our food, and then we end up getting things like reflux. So that creates a major stress in the body, because then the body has to work with all the negative outcomes of having partially digested food. Emotions. There's a great book by a woman named Candace Pert. It's called Molecules of Emotion. Has anybody read it? She is a scientist who in the 80s and 90s was very interested in how emotional stress makes people sick. And she was one of the first to discover that emotions actually do release molecules, of chemical molecules, like we generate them in the body, and they go to cells and they create a certain response. So we know that emotions actually produce a molecular response in the body. It's not just a, you know, feeling out here. And so emotions can make us sick. If we're constantly angry, if we're constantly sad, those kinds of molecules have a different effect on the body than the happy molecules. Then there are those externally generated sources of stress that we've talked about: news, radio, TV, traffic, a full calendar that doesn't have any space to breathe. So one of the reasons that I like to put these up here is that these are all some things that we can do something about, right? We can't change the tsunamis or the storm Sandys, but we can get more sleep. We can decide to make some changes in our diet. We can decide that we're going to eat always sitting down at a table with the place set and take a deep breath before we start. We can get exercise. We can work with our emotions. We can turn the television off. We can take another way if it's traffic. So just starting to think about how can I make more mindful choices to decrease some of these sources of stress so that I don't have to worry so much about my internal response. Questions, comments? Great. So, what determines our response to stress? Part of it is just knowing how it works in the body, right? If we know how it works and what triggers it, then we have the ability to make a choice. Our inner resources and our attitudes can definitely affect our response. There are many studies now that show that people with strong social networks have more resilience in the face of stress and have less recurrences of their chronic illnesses. And spiritual beliefs and practices also are another great support for diminishing our stress response. So what can we do to support a healthy metabolism in the face of a stressful life? Number one. Slow down. And this has to be a conscious choice now. How many of you have a really full calendar? Like when you look at it, there's no space. Right? I mean, I wake up in the morning some days and I look at my calendar and I go, oh, because I just don't see any breathing room in there, right? And so part of it is looking ahead and saying, okay, I'm going to create some breathing room. I'm going to make an appointment with myself. Instead of having all of these appointments with other people, I'm putting in one for myself. And I don't have to tell anybody who that appointment is with. I just say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't. I have an appointment then. And that's my breathing space. So we want to start to think of ways. So how can we slow down our world? Maybe it's, you know, not multitasking. Maybe it's turning off the talk radio that is going all the time. Whatever it is, looking for different ways to slow down. Mindful eating. So not only what we eat, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but how we eat, under what conditions. Are we eating under quiet, that relaxation response condition that I talked about? Breathe. So why does breathing relieve stress? Breathing relieves stress because physiologically, the lungs have stretch receptors. So when we breathe, they stretch and they stimulate the nervous system. The stretch receptors at the top part of the chest stimulate that contraction part of the nervous system. And the stress receptors deep in the lungs stimulate the relaxation response. So when we take a deep breath, we're literally stimulating the relaxation response. The biggest relaxation response in the body is called the vagus nerve. It comes out of the cervical spine, goes down through the chest cavity, follows the aorta, goes through the diaphragm, spreads out onto the stomach and the abdomen, the abdominal organs. When the diaphragm that separates the abdomen from the lungs, that's that really thin muscle that the vagus nerve goes through, when the diaphragm moves up and down, it stimulates the vagus nerve. It rubs on the nerve and it stimulates it. So when we take a deep breath, we're literally triggering the relaxation response. So we can quite literally start to turn the switch off just by doing deep breathing. Almost every spiritual tradition has a breathing practice. And it probably is related to the fact that it puts us into that meditative place. It puts us into the relaxation response. Think good thoughts about your food. So this goes back to the conditions under which we eat. If we sit down and look at our food and think, oh, you know, why did I make this choice, or why I'm eating this, or I don't like this, or it doesn't look good, all of those responses, like think those things to yourself right now. How do you feel? When I hear those things, I kind of go, I mean, it's that, again, it's that contracted spot. And so again, our digestion suffers when we don't think well about our food. So once we've made our choices about food, go with them. You know, just say, this is what I'm eating now. Bless this food to my body, and off I go. The other important thing is to watch your mind and how it judges what other people eat. I notice that I often look at other people's plates, especially because of my line of work, and I'm looking and thinking, oh, why are they eating that, you know? And I realize that if I'm doing that to them, I'm doing that to my food too, probably unconsciously. So it's really good to kind of start watching, you know, well, what do we think about our food? And really bring a positive energy to what we're choosing, because it has a metabolic response. It has a chemical response in our body. Questions or comments so far?
Yes. What is your opinion about fruit, berries, fruit that's sort of off-season here now is grown in Mexico or South America?
That's a good question. You know, my opinion is that always it's better to eat what's in season and grown locally, because the body is in those conditions, and the food is grown under conditions that are similar to what my body is living in, so it's more likely to be in line with the energy needs of my body. It just doesn't happen so much in our world. Personally, I do tend to avoid things like pineapples and mangoes in the dead of winter, because those are really tropical fruits, and that's not anywhere where my body is at the moment. There's a lot of wisdom in traditional cultures about why they eat the foods they do, and that's a big part of healing. But I think it's also about, you know, making reasonable choices and doesn't mean that you have to give up all those things, but maybe make your diet predominantly what's grown here now in this climate and use those other things as special items rather than having mangoes every day for breakfast in the winter. You know, maybe you have them once every couple of weeks or for a dinner party or something.
Yeah. When you think of the winter, what are typical foods that are healthy to eat right now?
There aren't many. Apples. I mean, apples are probably good. Apples and pears are the biggest ones. You know, some people think it's okay to eat oranges because they're grown in Florida, but it's not really where we are, you know. But it's more like apples and pears and dried fruits. Yeah, those are the big fruits for winter. Any other questions? Okay. So oxygen. Oxygen is part of that breathing thing, right? And it also, inside our cells, we have what are called mitochondria. They're the little energy engines in every cell. And each cell has many mitochondria. It can have hundreds of mitochondria. And the oxygen is what makes them turn, what makes their energy wheel turn. It's like the water on the water wheel. And for them, it's oxygen. And if we don't have enough oxygen and those mitochondria can't turn their wheels, they can't convert the food into energy. So it's food plus oxygen equals energy. So we have to breathe. So in addition to that stress relieving factor of breathing, oxygen is really important in making sure that we get good aeration. So this is one of the reasons why aerobic exercise can be useful, or taking a brisk walk, really expanding the lungs and getting a lot of oxygen in. Eating outdoors is good, but not in the winter. Digestion follows the sun. This is a traditional wisdom. I lived in India for a number of years, and I studied some Ayurvedic medicine. Is anybody familiar with Ayurveda? Yeah. It's the classical traditional medicine of India. And this is one of the precepts of Ayurvedic medicine, which is that digestion follows the sun. And that means that it's just waking up in the morning, just like we are. It's strongest at noon, at midday, and it's starting to wane in the evening. And if you think about it, if you look at traditional cultures, even Europe, when did they eat the biggest meal of the day? Yeah, at midday, at lunch, right? And they usually ate it in a fairly leisurely way. They would get together with their family group, and they would sit and they would eat for a couple of hours. Maybe they would take a siesta or not, depending on if they were northern or southern, but they would eat in a leisurely way and their largest meal. And supper was usually very small. Like in England, they would call it tea, right? It really wasn't much. We eat our biggest meal at dinner. Why is that?
Jobs.
It's really all about money, isn't it? I mean, we have constructed our lives around our work. And work calls for eating later. Our work doesn't allow us to really take time in the middle of the day to eat in a relaxed and slow way and to eat a large meal. We're always eating fast and we're eating small and we're just getting on with it. And so then we eat a large meal at dinner, particularly after the sun goes down, and our digestion isn't so good. And again, it's another one of these things that contributes to reflux and all the indigestion that we have because we eat too late and we eat too much too late. So I offer this to you as something to kind of think about, of trying to put a little more of your day's food into your lunchtime and a little less into your dinner time and see how you feel. See if you notice a difference in your energy and in your digestion and what happens. Yes?
Someone noticed, it was a gentleman who was going to Weight Watchers, and he noticed that he would stop eating after 3 o'clock and the weight was just coming right off him very easily.
Yeah, because our metabolism slows down at night. And the worst thing we can do is to go to bed with a full stomach. That food really goes to your hips and your waist. Yeah. When you eat, eat. So the point here is be present with your food, be present with the people that you're eating with, and not to not be distracted. Because when we're distracted, we don't pay attention to the quantity of food. We don't pay attention to how fast we eat. And when we overeat and we eat too fast, those kick in that cortisol, that stress hormone. And that's going to add to our digestive difficulties and the stress response in the body. So the idea is to be present with our food. Like, try, if you eat in front of the television, try turning it off. Try putting some music on instead of television and use that as an alternative. Or, you know, actually talk to the people that we're sitting with, or make a date with yourself and see what happens. See if that improves your sense of relaxation and quiet that comes into the body. I'm going to come back to that. One, the other thing I want to say about eating is that part of, I think, the reason why people say blessings before they eat, in addition to gratitude and the spiritual greatness of offering a blessing for what we're eating, is that I think it does give us a moment to just be present with ourselves and to switch the switch off, you know, to turn off that stress response. And when we sit down and close our eyes for a moment and bless our food and bless the people that we're with, the body has a chance to, like, say, oh, this is now. I'm about to eat. I'm about to do something that's nourishing. And so it gives us the opportunity to really turn the switch. And that's something that I hope that you walk away with tonight, is that there are ways to take that on switch that we're constantly in and turn it off. And we can do that by choosing these different options. Chewing. This is one of my favorite practices. 30 times, it says. Have any of you ever timed how many times you chew, your average bite? Yeah. But what I find, because I've done this surreptitious chewing survey where I've sat at the table with people and watched how many times they chewed before they swallowed. And it averages, I would say, somewhere between 4 and 7. Men tend to chew less. Women chew a little more, but that's a generalization that doesn't always hold. Try it for yourself and see how, like, what feels normal to you. Once you start to watch, you know, you may adjust a little bit, but you'll kind of get the gist of how many times you chew. In the Ayurvedic tradition, it said that you should chew every bite actually 32 times before you swallow it. And I invite you to try it and see what it's like. Number of things happen. When you get to about chew number 10, the switch turns off. And you will start to feel that relaxation response. Unless your mind is the kind that says, this is ridiculous. You know, you can hear the little tape. This is so boring. I just want to swallow my food. If that's your response, then your switch may not turn off. But if you can try and kind of step back from that voice, I think you'll notice that the switch will turn off at a certain point. When we chew for longer, we have enzymes in the mouth, and they actually pre-digest our food. They digest the starchy part of the food. So if you take like a saltine cracker that tastes salty, at about chew 12 or 13, it will start to taste sweet because the enzymes will have digested that starch into its sugar components, and the food will actually taste sweet. So good food will start to taste better the longer you chew it. Try that with a McDonald's Happy Meal, and I bet you won't find that it gets better as you chew it longer. I've tried it. But this is a really great way also to get more nutrition from your food and to lose weight. Because when you chew your food that many times, A, you will get bored, and you won't want to eat as much as you normally put on your plate. So you'll end up putting less food on your plate, and you get more nutrition from what you are eating. So I've seen people lose weight simply by chewing their food more. So I invite you to try it. See what happens. Regularity. So this is not just about your bowels. This is about your life. Regularity is the way to really restore your adrenals. So if you're one of those people who's waking up tired, the way to get back on track is to start putting regularity in your schedule. A regular wake-up time, a regular bedtime, regular meal times. Never skip meals. Your adrenals really thrive on predictability. And if you think about this, like, if we skip a meal, the body still needs a constant supply of blood sugar to make the brain work and to make our body work, right? If we skip a meal and there's no blood sugar coming in through our digestion, it's got to go looking for it somewhere in the body. And so it has to switch into the cortisol, into the stress system. Because the body reads a skipped meal as, it must be starvation time. If you think back to Paleolithic man only skipped a meal because they couldn't find the food to eat, right? I mean, they weren't concerned about their weight. They just ate when they were hungry or when it was time to eat. So evolutionarily, if we skip a meal, the body system goes, oh, must be starvation time. I'm going to start conserving calories. And so that's part of what happens. And the whole stress chemistry kicks in. When we eat regular meals and when we sleep regular times, the body gets into a rhythm and things feel very predictable. And that sense of, I have to worry, where's my next meal coming from? I'm not getting enough sleep. I can't sleep. That whole sense of stress starts to quiet down. And this starts to reverse that stress response. So predictability, regularity is the way to heal. Stress-relieving food choices. Low on the sugar. We talked about the effect that sugar has on your stress hormones. Avoiding caffeine. We talked about that. Protein with your meals. So the reason this is important is because protein almost always comes with a little fat. Like it's really hard to think of a protein except for maybe a protein powder that doesn't have fat with it. Like all animal proteins come with a little fat. The fat provides satisfaction and provides longevity of energy, right? Because fat is burned much more slowly than carbohydrates. And the protein is the building block for cells and for cellular energy. So when we have protein with every meal, our energy is going to be more sustained, our blood sugar is going to be more even, and we're going to avoid those spiky ups and downs and those crashes in our energy. And therefore, we're going to avoid those cortisol spikes from our adrenals. The adrenals need vitamin C, B5, and B6 to make cortisol. And so we want to make sure that all of the components, all the building blocks are there. So foods rich in vitamin C, the citrus fruits, strawberries, tomatoes, potatoes actually have a lot of vitamin C, except when we cook them, heat destroys it. Vitamin B5, egg yolks, broccoli, sweet potatoes, avocados are great for B5. And B6 is in mostly animal proteins like turkey, salmon, chicken, spinach. So all of those things will support your body to combat stress. So this is just a review. Ways to support a healthy metabolism. Breathe. Breathe while you eat. Oxygen provides the power for the furnace. When you eat, eat. Consider pausing before you start. Chew your food 30 times a bite. Think good thoughts about your food before you eat it. The strength of your digestive fire follows the sun. So think about moving more of your calories to the middle of the day. And in the end, it's all about being mindful. It's all about giving ourselves choice, right? The more awareness we have of these things, the more possibility we have to make a choice in any moment. So as we're reaching for the caffeine, we can go, wow, do I really need that caffeine right now? Or would it be better if I go have a handful of nuts to power me through the next two-hour meeting? So it's just, you know, as we reach for to turn the radio on to hear the 6 o'clock news, maybe we think, wow, you know, I've just been sitting with people who've been talking all day. I think I'll just not turn the radio on and give myself 15 minutes of quiet on the way home. So beginning to find ways to quiet our world, to make space in our calendars, to bring regularity into our lives, and to reverse those stress hormones and bring some peace of mind, body, and spirit. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Okay. What does wild salmon do for you with regular salmon?
That's a good question. The EnvironmentalDefenseFund.org has a great website, a great chart on fish and what they're contaminated with. And unfortunately, fish is really good for you in terms of proteins and the healthy fats that are in it, but so many of our fish are contaminated with PCBs and mercury, and some of them with pesticides. Wild salmon, so salmon specifically, is mostly contaminated with PCBs because when they come into spawn, they're bottom feeders, and PCBs collect on the bottoms of rivers and streams. So depending on where they're coming in to spawn, depends on how contaminated they are. In Alaska, there's very little PCB-related industry in the spawning grounds for salmon. Atlantic salmon is pretty contaminated because there's a lot of PCBs up and down the East Coast. Same thing for Washington State wild salmon, even. Puget Sound is pretty contaminated. So it really depends on where the fish is grown or where it's coming into spawn. Farmed salmon, again, maybe they're feeding that farmed salmon organic feed, but then you have the problem of they use a lot of antibiotics with farmed fish, depending on how crowded they are. And you also don't know what the ground is underneath where they're growing the salmon. So if you know the source of waters of where your salmon are being grown, then farmed salmon is not such a bad thing. But according to the Environmental Defense Fund website now, Atlantic salmon is one of the most contaminated fish. It's right there under swordfish. They recommend eating it once every other month. And it used to be like the thing I ate, it was my go-to fish.
The problem is when you go to a restaurant, you really don't know whether you can trust whether, even if it says wild salmon. Yeah. And usually it doesn't say.
If it doesn't say, it's not, because they're going to charge you more money. Yeah. That's my rule of thumb. And if they do say wild salmon, I mean, then you just have to know whether or not you can trust the place where you're eating. You know, I mean, but that's true of everything. Right?
You're saying that Atlantic salmon is highly contaminated? And it doesn't matter if you get it in a can or if it's wild Atlantic salmon?
Wild Atlantic salmon? I've never seen wild Atlantic salmon, actually. I don't know.
What about Scottish salmon? Because I thought that was okay.
I think Scottish and Norwegian are probably safer. Again, it kind of depends on industry. And my understanding is that Norway and Scotland don't have the same kind of, you know, PCB-related industry that we do. And so I think it is safer. But I recommend the EnvironmentalDefenseFund.org website because they have a whole lot on not only on what fish are contaminated, but also on what's sustainable versus non-sustainable.
And what is it? Environmental?
DefenseFund. It's EDF.org is the website. Yeah.
Out of everything you just presented, what do you find you yourself, what's the biggest challenge for you and how do you go about dealing with it?
That's a good question. I think the two biggest challenges for me, one is sugar. I love sugar. I love cookies. Give me a cookie and I'm a happy girl. So I really have to watch my tendency. For sugar. And so I do it preemptively by, I have nuts with me, like I always have a thing of nuts in my purse, so that if I get hungry, I can go there instead of going to sugar. I rarely keep cookies in my house because I know I'll just eat the whole box. And then the other is overscheduling. I just have to really make those dates with myself and create space.
And then my last question for you is, where would alcohol fit into this presentation in terms of, I'm sure it has effects on both stress and metabolism, so any words on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So alcohol is basically sugar in a bottle, right? In addition to what it does to our liver, it's broken down into simple sugars, and so it does all those things that sugar does, which is spikes our cortisol. Spikes glucose, which spikes insulin, which leads to the insulin resistance and the cortisol response. You get these layers of what sugar does to make your blood sugar go up and down and creates inflammation. Insulin is very inflammatory, so the more insulin we're putting out to handle our blood sugar, the more inflammation we're creating in the body. So generally speaking, alcohol is inflammatory and wreaks havoc with our blood sugar, which is fatiguing to the adrenals.
So if you're diabetic and you're on insulin, is that putting inflammatory things in your body?
Well, no, because all of us have insulin, right? I mean, that's part of what we need. And the idea when you're taking insulin is to get you just the right dose so that it's not too much and not too little, right?
I read somewhere about canned foods, like anything in cans, you should use glass bottles for purchases versus cans. Is that accurate?
Glass is the safest. I mean, glass doesn't put anything into our food. The problem with cans is a lot of them were lined with BPA, that nasty plastic. So you do need to read your can to see if it's BPA free. If there's if it's a lined can, you want to make sure that it's BPA free. Mm-hmm. And the metal is probably not much of an issue unless it's a really acidic food.
You think of anything like one of those greens, you know, the beans, and sardines, anything, you know, I've never seen sardines in a jar, in a...
And I think actually things like sardines are probably less of a problem because the oils are less, I think less is pulled into to the oily things. I think their bigger issue is the more acidic foods.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think of frozen vegetables?
I think they're better than canned. You know, I think there's more nutrition, there are more enzymes preserved in frozen vegetables than in canned. But and they're like a good choice. We were talking about seasonal things, right? There are certain things that I think, like you can't, it's hard to get good green peas unless you get them frozen, except for a very narrow window in the year. And I think that's a pretty reasonable frozen food to eat, or frozen blueberries. Blueberries are high in antioxidants and bioflavonoids. They're low in sugar, so it's a great fruit. So it's, again, going mostly for fresh, mostly for whole, and supplementing with canned or frozen when you need to.
So I think a certain brand, when it's canned, like Eden, I think Eden's not
bad. Right, I think they are BPA-free.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and most of the European things that are packaged in Europe.
And how do you feel about... organic versus non-organic? Maybe you covered this.
No, that's a good question. So there are a couple of reasons why I personally think organic is really a good idea. One is the planet. And what we put on our food in terms of chemicals, both fertilizers and pesticides, are causing grave harm to the planet. And if you watch the Discovery Channel or PBS, every once in a while they'll have one of those shows where they show the frogs that are totally deformed because they're living in the runoff from the pesticides from the field. And, you know, that's the test animal. And we see it in our practice all the time. We see people who have, women especially, who have a really bad PMS. And that's a condition called estrogen dominance. Means relative to progesterone in the body, those are the two big female hormones, estrogen is high. And the reason for that is not necessarily because the person is producing more estrogen, but because there are many things in our environment that act like estrogen, and pesticides are one of them. And plastics, plasticizers like phthalates and BPA actually, act like estrogen in the body. So over time, and think of those little girls that are playing soccer on those big fields that they come and spray pesticides on. So we see a lot of teenagers, for instance, who have problems with their periods because they've had so much pesticide exposure. And when you give them things to help them get rid of estrogen, to just mobilize it and get it out of the body, their periods come back. A lot of those PMS symptoms go away. So there's that aspect of pesticides, what it's doing to our environment, and then what it's doing to us.
What are you telling them to take to mobilize the estrogen?
There's a combination, and we actually have a supplement, it's called Estrofactors, and it's a combination of B vitamins, a thing called DIM, diindolylmethane, indole 3, carbinol, I3C. So there are certain supplements that are used in the detoxification pathways of estrogen in the liver. My biochemists have looked at that. They know what it takes to metabolize estrogen and get it out of the body. And certain of those substances are available in supplements. So we actually give people low doses of those and they start to mobilize estrogen. We do that a lot with women who have breast cancer to make sure that they're getting, because even women who've had breast cancer and taken tamoxifen or whatever, they're still producing small amounts of estrogen. So we want to make sure that the estrogen is detoxified and out of the body and on its way. And that's a tried and true mechanism of part of the program for preventing recurrence.
I never understood this. Estrogen is good. It keeps you young and vital, and then all of a sudden you reach an age, and then it's bad. Why?
That's a good question. For whatever reasons, you know, the body goes through a change, and it starts to change its metabolism. And estrogen, after a certain age in higher amounts, isn't healthy. We have estrogen receptors on the cells. And there, again, all of these receptors, there's one that stimulates and one that blocks. So there's an accelerator and there's a brake. And different kinds of estrogens are produced after menopause than before. And we have more, we tend to have more of the accelerator and less of the brake after menopause. So when we take hormones and we've got an imbalance in the kinds of estrogens, we can actually end up stimulating those estrogen receptors more when in fact we need to be putting on the brakes. So the body has its wisdom, right? It knows this. And it basically, if it doesn't have a lot of interference from the outside, it can make the modifications it needs and balance those out. But because of how we live our lives now, the body doesn't always know. It doesn't always have what it needs to make those delicate balances. And when we introduce estrogens artificially, it can put things out of balance. We don't know as much as we'd like to. I mean, we do use some bioidentical hormones in our practice, but we don't use them as our go-to postmenopausal treatment. We really only use them for people who are terribly symptomatic and don't know what to do otherwise for the shortest amount of time possible. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat.
Yeah. It's really about, I would say the bottom line, it's about the strength of estrogens. And after menopause, the body tends to produce the stronger estrogens instead of the weaker ones, and the weaker ones are more protective.
What kind of vitamins do you recommend in your practice for gut health?
We do. We recommend a good multivitamin, multimineral, a little bit of fish oil, unless you're eating fish frequently, but most people aren't. And we test people for their levels, and they're almost always low, and vitamin D. Those are kind of our go-to, everybody needs this, and women need about 500 milligrams of calcium. We used to think women need 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium, but in 2011, a study was published, I think, in the British Medical Journal, re-examining the Women's Health Initiative data, and they looked at calcium. And what they found is that 600 milligrams of calcium or more per day increased your risk of heart attack more than it decreased your risk of hip fracture. And so our recommendation is less calcium is better in terms of a supplement, but you should still look for it in your diet. Yeah.
On calcification, and is there anything that you can do in diet once you start to have calcified veins?
Yes, inflammation. It's all about quieting inflammation. Because calcium goes to where inflammation is. It's trying to put out the fire. Calcium is one of the buffers for fire. And so whatever you can do that's anti-inflammatory, so all these things we just talked about are anti-inflammatory in terms of the stress reducers. Fish oil is anti-inflammatory. Looking at your diet and going to a more anti-inflammatory diet, which is lean protein, heavy in fruits, veggies, nuts, and berries, less of the other fruits, and very little grains. That's a very good anti-inflammatory diet.
Low on grains?
Low on grains.
So the nuts and the fish, the fat from them is...
Healthy fat.
It's healthy fat.
It's healthy fat.
It is healthy, it doesn't.
It really is. Yeah, it really is.
Mm-hmm. There's something new out now about there's something in wheat, in a type of wheat, that either causes cancer or heart disease. Do you know about that?
Well, We should do a talk on gluten one night and wheat in general, because there are many problems with it. There was a great article yesterday in the New York Times about gluten. It was a good beginning. And then there was the one in this weekend of the woman and her son who had wheat sensitivity, gluten sensitivity. There's a great book I'll refer to you. We're in a library. It's called Wheat Belly.
Wheat Belly.
Wheat Belly. I highly recommend it. Yeah. I think we have time for one more question.
I have a question. You're talking about nuts and how healthy they are. I read somewhere that peanuts are toxic. Is that true?
Peanuts can have a thing called aflatoxin, which is a fungus that gets connected to the peanut. And that's probably the biggest problem. And some people are really sensitive to it. It's a poison, basically. But it's in minute.
You should eliminate that then when you're eating nuts?
You know, I say go more in the direction of walnuts and almonds and less in the direction of peanuts. And probably the almond butter is a better choice in the long run than peanut butter. But if you're getting organic peanuts, that's probably, you know, a better choice. But generally, we tend to steer people more towards walnuts and almonds than to peanuts. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for coming. It was delightful to be here. And I think Bernadette, is she here? We have another Blum talk coming up later this month, I think. It should be in the library. When is it? Okay. It's on metabolism? Okay. I do also want to, I'm going to plug our new Learn to Relax toolkit. This is going to be available March 1st, and it's a 10-day program, 10 minutes a day, of really simple things that you can do for stress relief. And it comes with a CD that has guided meditations and a breathing exercise. 1st of March, it'll be available. Thank you.